Welcome to the Dental Implant Podcast with your host, Pav Kara, your source of knowledge for all things relating to dental implants. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something valuable. I hope.
Folks, welcome back to the next episode of the Dental Implant Podcast. And I'm actually very excited to be talking about ceramic implants today with none other than Sami Numbisi. Now, if you've even remotely looked at ceramic implants, Sami's name has probably come up. We are very, very fortunate to have Sami joining us today. So, Sami, we've known each other for what, about 18 months, something like that? And I've been picking your brains quite a bit on ceramic implants, haven't I? So we've been trying to get this podcast up and running for about 6 months as well. So thank you for joining me, Sami. So if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself to the listeners, because you've got some fantastic credentials behind you, and I want them to understand who is giving this advice.
Well, my name is Dr. Sami Numbisi. I went to dental school here in the United States at Howard University in Washington, D.C., where I got my Doctor of Dental, my DDS degree. Then I forwarded my education by attending the implant residency program at Loma Linda in California, a three-year full-time residency program in implantology. And I've been in private practice since 2000, the year 2000, exclusively practicing implantology. About 15 years ago, I made a transition into a ceramic implant. And I've done a lot of practice and research and publication on the matter. It's a very exciting time in implant dentistry, and I'm very fortunate and honored to be part of this transition and this new era in dental implantology.
Amazing. Thanks, Sami. So, I mean, I've got a list of simple questions, and I think partly it's to help the listeners understand, but these are genuinely some questions that I have for you as well. So I'm looking to learn from you as well. So can you give us a little bit of a history about ceramic implants? You know, describe for us basically what ceramic implants are and how long they've been around.
Well, ceramic implants are exactly what they are. Their name says they're ceramic. But then again, they're special types of ceramics. But let's start with a little bit of the history. You know, ceramic implants were started to be investigated from millennia, because there's some skulls that have been found with shells. And we know shells are also made of a ceramic. But the modern ceramic implant started in earnest in the 60s. And one of the early pioneers, I consider the brand mark of ceramic implants, was the late Professor Sami Sandhaus, who from Switzerland, who originally from Romania, but from Switzerland, who started developing ceramic implants in the 60s. So actually, if you look at the publications and the history, Sandhaus was working almost in parallel with Brandmark without them really interacting that much. And he started experimenting with ceramic implants. At the time, they were made of a different type of ceramic. They were mostly made of alumina, okay? So aluminium oxide. So oxides of aluminium, alumina, and that's what he started with, and had some implants produced and placed in patients in those early days. So that started in around the early 60s. So the idea of going ceramic with a dental implant is not new. Okay, it's just that it started in the 60s. It had a rough start, I have to say, because ceramics were not that sophisticated at the time. And they have evolved to a point where in the last 15, 20 years now, a little more than that, the advanced ceramics that have evolved from those original alumina and others have led now to these ceramic implants we have in the market now that are a lot more reliable, a lot more adapted to the needs, and can also respond well to the applications that are needed for oral rehabilitation.
So, Sami, just to clarify, are you saying that ceramics implants probably haven't taken off as much as what titanium ones have, despite them being around for the same length of time, because early on, the ceramics that were available aren't as good as what they are today? Is that correct?
That's correct. That means, let me go a little more into detail with that, is that, again, the original ceramic implants were all what you call monoclinic. Okay, they were made only of one ceramic, either 100% alumina or 100% zirconia or something else. The problem is that alumina did not have the flexibility necessary in terms of structural bending and taking forces that metals can take. So it's very brittle. And zirconia, 100% zirconia, is very sensitive to humid environments. So the oral environment is very humid, and the chewing forces and the chewing cycles can require materials that can take a little bit of, that are flexible to a certain extent. So those two materials were the original ones, and used at 100% never really did well. And then also the original ceramic implants also had very glassy, smooth surfaces, which also is an issue in terms of osseointegration, because we know osseointegration likes a roughened surface. So the ceramics that we are, you and I are using now, that we are able to purchase and place in our patients, they are ceramic composites. So now they're not made of 100% alumina or 100% zirconia. They're made of alumina, zirconia, and yttria. Okay, so now you have these composites that now have better physical properties, that are not sensitive to humidity, that have a little more flexibility, and that are more adaptable to the needs that we have in oral rehabilitation today.
Makes sense. Okay, so why choose a ceramic over a titanium implant?
Well, ceramic has a lot of properties. First of all, let's talk about metals a little bit. Metals, when placed in certain environments, are invariably going to have some degree of breakdown. And breakdown is the word, code word, or the nice word for corrosion. Okay, that's a big problem we have in metals. And this is something that our colleagues in orthopedics have known since the 50s, for a long time.
Yes.
That over time, a metal placed in a biological environment is going to corrode. So what happens is when a metal corrodes, it invariably releases some of its components. Again, you got to remember, these metals are alloys. So when you have a metal alloy that corrodes, it releases some of its components. And we know that there's no such thing as 100% pure titanium. There's always some other components within the alloy, like vanadium, chromium. Actually, the commercially available titanium implants are made of titanium, vanadium, and aluminium. Those are the three main components that are listed on the manufacturer's safety data sheet. But there's also minute amounts of others. So that's why when you see the formulations of titanium alloys, they always say TI, ALV, and others. The others can be nickel, chromium, and other things. So to go back to your question, why ceramic versus titanium? Besides the corrosion problem, there's also another factor, is the surface energy. The surface energy of titanium alloys or titanium is higher than that of ceramics. That's why you'll find that you have more of an accumulation of plaque and bacteria on metal surfaces compared to ceramic surfaces. And there's a lot of studies, Rimondini and Scarano and others have published papers where this is very well documented, that the surface energy of metal being higher tends to attract more plaque, therefore more bacteria, creates an acidic environment, and then that's why you tend to see also a lot more inflammation around metal abutments or metal implants compared to ceramic. Okay, so the ceramic use here is not, it's also, there's a third component to the ceramic, is aesthetics. We know that we tend to have grain behind metal components, metal abutments, whereas with the ceramic, it's white, its translucency is pretty good. Therefore, the optical value of ceramic is also good. So there's an aesthetic component, there's a biological component, and there's also a structural component. So that's where the clinician has to weigh, based on the case that they receive and the patient, which direction they want to go.
So this ties in to what I've discussed previously with regards to corrosion of dental implant surfaces as well. Okay, so we know that it's a problem. We know that commercially pure grade four titanium, which is predominantly kind of like European and Korean based stuff. Okay. What you tend to get over in the Americas is a grade five plus. And the reason why I call it grade five plus is because some companies say, oh, it's grade 23. It's not, it's still the same components in there. But as you said, even commercially pure grade four titanium, it will still have some element of impurities in it. Now, what we know, and this is something that's been shown, I think it was by Thomas Albrechtsen more recently as well, is the whole osteoimmunology concept, that actually it's a homeostasis. It's not a, you know, we get binding of the bone to the implant surface and that's it. And I've said before on the podcast, and this is what I teach as well, is that, look, if we're using titanium implants, that, you know, we shouldn't use chrome abutments to it, because you're creating a galvanic effect, which is increasing the amount of corrosion further, okay? Now, some people may argue and turn around and say, you know what, I don't have problems with this type of stuff because, you know, I've been placing implants for 5, 6, 7 years and everything's fine. But what we're talking about, Sammy, is we're not talking about like short to medium term. We're kind of like talking long term, you know. So this is my understanding of it as well, is, you know, we're not talking that, you know, the corrosion can potentially cause a short term problem. It's a medium to long term problem. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, ceramic implants, they have been on my radar. I've started placing them. I've placed a decent handful now. And, you know, I believe it's going to be a strong part of my armamentarium moving forward. So talking about corrosion resonates with kind of like what I already know as well. So yeah, it makes sense. So I wanted to talk to you as well, you know, one piece versus two piece ceramic implants, because one of my concerns has always been, particularly with two piece ceramic implants, quite often you get, you know, fiberglass screws, or there's zirconia screws, or it's something that, you know, What's the longevity of these? Should we be looking at one piece systems, or do we have solid evidence that actually, you know what, these types of screws, they're stable long term? Could you tell us a little bit more about the one piece systems, two piece systems, and the different connections and screws that you get for them, please?
So when you look at a history of ceramic implants, as a matter of fact, the early implants, commercially available implants, like the ones Sandhouse developed, he started with a two-piece and quickly reverted to a one-piece and eventually went back to two-piece. So he, even in his early days of conceptualizing ceramic implants, or even the Tubingen implant that everybody knows that gave ceramic implants an early, early bad rap, they started two-piece. Okay. So today, where we stand for the last 15, 20 years, we've had about 3 or 4 types of connections on ceramic implants. For example, the Zeramex implant initially came with what was literally a clone of the early tissue level implants from Straumann with an external hex. So it was a ceramic implant, a copy and paste of the tissue level Straumann with an external hex. Then there have been now a variety of internal connections. And of course, at the beginning of all that, there's always been one piece implants. Now, when I started ceramic implantology, placing ceramic implants, there were all that was available, commercially available, were one piece implants. So that's all there was. That's what we had to make work, whatever the scenario was, single molars, anteriors, full arches, whatever. They worked fairly well. There were certain skeletal profiles, like if you have a strong back maxillary protrusion, they could be tricky in such cases. But in most cases where you were trying to replace a premolar or molar, pretty much a quite vertical positioning of the implant, the one piece does well, as long as you protect it, you know, with some type of appliance. So the one piece implant, if you ask me, is probably better suited when you have partial edentulism, where you can have a device that protects the implant during the osseointegration time. Now we have these. So again, because it was tough, we kept begging and asking the developers to make two-piece implants. So now comes the two-piece in different types of configuration. You have cemented ceramic abutments, cemented abutments that are ceramic to be cemented to the ceramic implants, You have like what you mentioned, the fiber post. Then we have abutments that, like Ceramex again, came with abutments that were ceramic, but that were screwed. Okay, and they use a carbon fiber screw, the V-Carbo that we all know. And then you have, for example, Neodent that has a metal screw that's connecting two ceramic components, meaning the abutment and the implant. So now you see that there's an evolution. There's a variety of connections coming with a variety of, in two concepts, either a cementable concept or a screw retain concept, which is nice because now with a screw retain, you can expand the range of applications. You can now go into wider rehabilitations. You can go into full arches and you have that flexibility that we've had with titanium where you can undo the prosthesis, service it. You know, the flexibility you have is screw retained. So if you ask me what's my favorite connection, I'll say I like one-piece implants. I'll use one-piece implants wherever I can because here's my rationale. One, you only have, when you use a one-piece implant, you get rid of one connection. It becomes like a tooth. Okay? So there's less moving part.
Right? Ends up being tissue level, yeah.
Absolutely. It ends up being tissue level. There's one less connection, one less moving part, right? Now, depending on your philosophy and where you stand, the downside is, and I say the downside, is that it's cemented. But we cement crowns to teeth. We don't expect to go and have to remove them. So on implants, why we should have the same attitude. It's, you know, place the implant properly in a way where when we put a crown on it, we probably will never have to remove it unless there's a catastrophic problem. Okay, so again, depending where you stand, some of us like screw retained, some of us like cemented, but with a one piece, you have no option but cemented. But again, the upside of the one piece is that there's only one connection between the crown and the implant, just like with the tooth. Now the two piece, like I said, there's cemented abutments, screw retained abutments, and within the screw retained abutments, there's different types of screws. Like you mentioned, there's some ceramic screws, there's some carbon fiber screws, there's some metal screws, okay? Now, here's where sometimes things can get a little tricky because the way metals and ceramics behave under stress is different. So when you have a metal screw holding two ceramic components, well, you have a metal screw that is flexible, that stretches and whatever, and then you have components that are less flexible than that screw. So theoretically, you're increasing the chances maybe of fractures, of material failure, especially on the ceramic side, because metal can bend for a long time back and forth before it breaks. Now, when you use a cementable abutment, now for anything to be cemented, and we'll probably talk about cement a little later, but for anything to be cemented, you need a space for it. Otherwise, you can't cement it. This is just, you need the cement between the abutment and the body of the, and the wall of the implant, right? So that means over time, there's a chance that that cement might wash out. And if it washes out, the abutment starts to move. And when the abutment starts to move, now you can increase the chance of fracture. So I don't think there's not enough background on cemented abutments. There's not been enough research done to assess them over long term. But in my hands, for example, I've been doing cemented abutments for about 10 years, 11 years, because I had to do one piece for about 5 years before the first two piece came out. And I said they do well. They do really well, you know. Again, it's the prosthetically driven placement that really, really, again, even with titanium, drives the predictability and the success of those implants, whether it's one piece or two piece.
Yeah. So, you know, coming back to exactly what you just said, Sammy, is, you know, people don't understand the impact of having a malpositioned implant. Even if it's restorable, it completely changes the forces which go through the implant. You know, so I hear what you're saying, and I use a very similar philosophy to yourself, is that, you know, I don't place implants under the assumption that I'm going to have to remove them at a later date. I place them under the assumption that I'm trying to get them to last forever. If there is a failure of any point, then I'll have to deal with that in whatever way possible. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you spoke a few moments ago about the cementable small abutment. So what systems are available where you have cementable abutments?
Well, right now, at least in the North American market, you have SDS, Swiss Dental Solutions. They have the abutments are cementable. They have a screw, but the screw is really for the cementation. So you use a screw just to engage the abutment. Once the cementation is complete, you take it out. It's a peak screw, as a matter of fact. The other system that has a cementable abutment, I haven't used it in years, but Z-Systems, I think, still has a cementable abutment. That's on the North American market. That's all. I think that's it. The others, like Neodent, Ceramex, Nobel, Pearl, yes, they're all screw retained. And Ceramex and Nobel are the only ones that have the carbon fiber screw, well, the carbon fiber peak screw, the black screw, which is interesting because it's a screw that's not reusable. So it's one of these screws where if you put a crown in and at some point the patient comes back and it's chipped or they want to replace it or whatever, if you undo that screw, I'm talking about a carbon fiber peak screw, you can't reuse it. You have to replace it. Whereas the Neodent with their metal screw, just like a titanium implant, unless the screw is stripped or whatever, you can still reuse it. So those are pretty much the two broad groups of connections and methods of connecting abutments to ceramic dental implants.
And just for clarity, Sammy, when we use a cementable abutment, we're basically turning it into effectively a crown prep. So you still have a cement retained crown. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct. So if you cement an abutment, now it's cemented. You prep it or you adjust it whichever way you need to adjust it, and then you cement the crown over. Now,
nice and simple.
Yeah, exactly. Or sometimes, especially with the sometimes you can have the abutment cemented, then that's in the case of the carbon fiber screw and the metal screw. You can have the abutment and the crown cemented in the lab, and then you have a screw to screw retain it. But here's a downside. You follow me? But the downside of that is, especially with the Nobel Pearl and the Ceramex, which they're essentially the same implant, the screw is so large, the head of the screw is large, that if you were to deal, let's say, with a lateral incisor, you could potentially not be able to do a screw retain crown with that. You have no choice but to do cemented. Because again, you need a certain amount of bulk to the ceramic for it to be able to withstand forces. If you have it too thin, it will crack or it will break. Mm-hmm. So the screw from the Neodent is small enough that you can probably get away with that with small teeth. But for example, with a Vicarbo screw, you can't because it's a large screw and you need to have a sufficient amount of ceramic bulk around it so that you don't expose your implant or your crown to fracture. So there's trade-offs. That's why I say this all the time to our colleagues. I say, when you want to get into ceramic implants, just humble yourself a little bit, talk to somebody who has done quite a few, get a little bit of training, because the concept is the same, but there's a lot of nuances that come into play by virtue of the material you're playing with, which is very different from titanium, and how that material is going to respond to the design of your prosthesis or to the placement of your implant.
Interesting, very interesting. So what are the contraindications and potential drawbacks for ceramics? So obviously we spoke about potential material failure. Are there any specific contraindications? Are there any other drawbacks?
They're not necessarily only contraindications. What I would probably say is, and that's based on my clinical experience, if you have a patient that has a strong bite or who has a history of being a Brox or whatever, you know, when they get implants, that bite is going to come back with a vengeance. That strength, that bite force usually comes back. And I see in such cases, sometimes ceramic implants will not always be the best solution, you know, because they're very rigid. They don't bend like titanium. They don't give as much in terms of stress and bending and all that kind of stuff. So although now things are moving so fast, I've seen some materials, some prosthetic materials like Zerpeak, another material that I peak at zirconia composites, that claim, and that has not been fully tested, but that claim to flex enough that allow to relieve much of that occlusal stress being transferred down directly to the implants. Now, I have a couple, I say maybe four or five cases that I've done like that. They're very early in their lives. They're only 2 years old. So nothing has happened so far, but that's what the manufacturer of that particular material claims, that this material is suitable for especially extensive prosthetics on zirconia implants. Okay. Now, you were asking about contraindication. So there's really no contraindication. It's more case selection. You have to select the case properly and plan it properly. And sometimes by doing so, what would appear like a contraindication, it really isn't. It's just that you have to plan a little differently. And one aspect that I always like to bring to the fore is the biological component. Again, at the end of the day, we can have the best thread design, the best surgeon, the whatever, the best material, is how does the body interact or respond to that material? Because, and this is another discussion that we can have for a day or full day, is the osseointegration of zirconia implants. How do they osseointegrate the same way that titanium osseointegrates? Well, if you look at ceramic implants, they don't have any coatings. There's no HA-coated ceramic implant on the market. There's no RBM-coated. It's the implant itself, the ceramic, the zirconia itself, that's modified to be to allow osseointegration. Whereas with titanium implants, the majority of commercially available titanium implants or sold on the market, they have some level of coating. So now we're sliding into the surface treatment. Okay, so again, why is this? So how is the bone? How are the bone cells going to respond to that surface? So now you find that the osseointegration of zirconia, of bone to zirconia, is more of osseointegration to the zirconia itself. Whereas on titanium implants, it's osseointegration to the coating of the implant. So what does that mean? It's very important. That's a very important factor, because now you need a healthy bone, because there's no inductive capability in zirconia. Whereas the coatings that are on titanium, some of them have inductive potentials. So now when you decide you're going to place ceramic implants, you probably want to have a patient that you have evaluated their health or their ability to heal from that procedure or to make bone. So this is where, when you get into ceramic implants, once again, in some respects, you have to up your game. You have to know, can this patient heal well enough without any induction, for example? So these are little things. So the contraindications, they're not really there. But again, yes, there's some situations where the ceramic implant might not be the best option because of biomechanics or because the patient just is not healthy. Because the titanium implants can heal, integrate in some very bad environments. Ceramic implants are not that forgiving. Yeah.
So do ceramic implants, do they take longer to osseointegrate, or is it the same rate?
It's the same rate. It's just that, granted that this person is capable of, is healthy enough to heal. And what do I mean by that? I probably need to elaborate on that. For bone healing to happen, and you mentioned a little bit of the osteoimmunological component of things. For an implant to osseointegrate, you need bone turnover, right? So what that means is your patient has to be able to, after the injury, because surgery is an injury. When you drill that hole in the bone, it's an injury. Then you place an implant in there. Now you need that injury to heal. And in the process of healing, accept that implant. Take a hold of it. So what does the patient need for that? The patient needs to be healthy. Nutrients, vitamin D, minerals. You know, in dentistry, we do a lot of surgeries without even doing blood work.
Yeah.
And by and large, they're successful. Most of the time, they're successful procedures. It might be because they're not as invasive, but we just do surgeries and they turn out well. So the body has this ability to heal. But you find that with ceramic implants, you tend, if those things are not checked or optimized, or at the very least asked about to the patient before you go into surgery, you find that sometimes you'll have a higher failure rate. In my early days, every time I had a failure, not every time, but a lot of times when I had failures, and then I went right back and checked some of these variables, cholesterol, vitamin D, magnesium, some of these minerals, a lot of times they will be low. Now, do I necessarily? Now, there's a lot of literature that says, you know, if vitamin D is low, or cholesterol is high, or of course blood sugar, we know diabetics have problems, the chances of failure is higher, or you might have to wait a little longer. Exactly, you might have to wait a little longer for osseointegration. So again, the osseointegration time is about the same, 4 months, 5 months, plus or minus, and you can restore. So it's the same.
Okay.
But for ceramic, you got to do a little more due diligence. Yeah.
Yes, understood. So next questions I have for you, Sammy, they're a little bit more controversial, okay? Firstly, for those listening, you get a lot of people that turn around and say, oh, I offer ceramic implants because the patients don't want metal. And some people immediately turn around and say, oh, you're placing zirconia implants. Did you know zirconia is a metal? So when you get a chance, answer that one, okay? Secondly, there's also I found it to be a misnomer that if you start to offer ceramic implants, that you start to get the crazy holistic patients coming in, okay? Mm-hmm. So I have to say the patients that I have done ceramic implants for, and I did a full arch for a lady, okay? And they're actually the vast majority of them, and I'm not going to say all of them, but the vast, vast majority of them, they're completely reasonable. They just don't want metal in their mouth, okay? And then there's the final aspect where we get some colleagues who fearmonger patients as well into, you know, titanium's really bad. So could you just give us your opinion on these three things, please, Sammy? Just clarify those three points for us, please.
The first is zirconia metal or ceramic? Okay, so I think that was one of the first points.
Yes,
that's something that is getting better, but is still very poorly understood among our colleagues. It's unfortunate because I still hear people saying things as zirconium implants and things like that. The closest to the zirconium metal implant is the Straumann BLX, and that's about it, commercially available. Otherwise, when you're talking about a ceramic implant, you're talking about a zirconia implant, the oxide of the metal called zirconium. So if anybody goes to the table of elements, you see things like zirconium, titanium, yttrium, a lot of aluminium. All these metals are called transition metals. These are metals that when exposed to oxygen under certain conditions can transition into crystals and become ceramics. That's why you have yttrium that becomes yttria, titanium that becomes titania. By the way, titania is that famous oxide layer we all like to talk about. That oxide layer on the surface of your titanium implant, titania, it's exactly that. It's an oxidized state of titanium and is no longer metal. Okay. Same thing with zirconia. Zirconia is an oxidized state of zirconium. So you call it zirconium dioxide implant, which is a mouthful. And it's easier just to say a zirconia implant. Now, I hope everybody's clear on that. So there's no zirconium implant on the market. And if you're talking about ceramic implants, you should be talking about a zirconia implant. It's a lot easier for you and it's a lot easier for your patients, because once you start telling your patient about a zirconium dioxide implant, they might hear another metal. Okay.
Yes.
So there's this little terminology
the terminology, right?
Yes. And it's very important because it can lead to confusion. So zirconia implants, zirconia, titania, yttria, alumina. Okay. So the zirconia implant that you can purchase from any given system, the company, is made of zirconia, alumina, zirconia, and yttria. Okay. So what they do individually, we can talk a little about later, but they're ceramic. Now, what I like to share with our colleagues is that the type of patient that comes to your practice and specifically requests from you to do ceramic implants, in general, is a patient that has done his homework or her homework. Okay, I find that a lot of our colleagues get either intimidated or put off by patients that come and challenge them because let's be honest. When you and I were students, we had to go to the library in the stacks to find certain type of information. Today, for good or bad, everything is on Google. Everything is everything is very, very, very readily available. So you find patients that come in, they don't understand everything that they read, but a lot of us have made it very easy for the layperson to understand what we're talking about. So if they come and ask for a ceramic implant, they're not crazy. That's what they want, like you rightfully said a while ago. And there's enough solutions out there today in the ceramic world to address, I would say, 90, 95% of the dental rehabilitation needs. We used to be very limited 10 years ago. Today, the limitations are just narrowing. So that was, I think that was the second aspect you brought up.
Yes.
The third one was, what was it again? You asked me.
It was, I'm not accusing everybody who places zirconia implants of this, but I know some people deliberately use it as a marketing tool and they will scaremonger patients. Okay.
Yes.
When I offer ceramic implants to my patients, I give it to them as a choice. Okay. I say to my patients, look, some people just don't want metal in their mouth. Some people have a genuine allergy to titanium, but it's exceptionally rare. And most patients are just like, I just don't want titanium in my mouth, which is fine. It's not a problem, but I'm aware. And, you know, it may be an element of, I need to understand better or whatever it is. But I feel that there is a small cohort where they use the risk of corrosion, et cetera, to scare patients into ceramic implants. What are your, I know it's a little bit of a controversial topic, but I'd appreciate your thoughts on that, please, Sammy.
Yes, it's controversial because, again, like I was saying earlier, there's cases where you cannot use anything but a titanium implant. Those who think it's going to completely go away, it's not going to happen. Again, you have these people with very strong muscles, strong bite. I'm not going tight. I'm not going ceramic with those. I have in the past, and the results were not very good in some cases, in some extreme cases. So, and I have also done in other cases, and it's been no problem. So again, it comes back down to case selection. But to completely try to coerce a patient into a ceramic implant at any cost, in any type of situation, that's not the right way to do it.
Yeah,
I think there's situations where, like you said, there's people who have genuine sensitivities to certain metals. And it might not be even titanium itself. It could be all the other minute impurities that are found in that titanium alloy that bothers them. You know, there's what you call the tip-over effect. There's people out there that are sensitive to certain metals. There's two scenarios. There's those who are, and those who are not yet. And you come and drop that extra implant or two or whatever, they blow up.
Yeah.
So that's a tip-off reaction, okay? We have that category of patients. And then you have another category of people who have had sensitivity to metals and have learned over time to avoid those irritants. So you would run into a patient will come to your office, no jewelry. To me, that's a red flag. No jewelry, no makeup, plastic glasses or whatever. Have you ever had problems with metals? Yeah, when I was 15, I discovered that if I wear this or if I do that, I'll have hives, I'll have rashes or whatever. Oh, did that happen again? No, it hasn't happened in 10 years. Why? Well, I've been avoiding that type of jewelry, or I've been avoiding this type of food or whatever. So sometimes you have these patients who say, oh, I'm fine now, but it's because they've avoided the irritant. But you have what you call memory immunity. Okay, so now when you come with that titanium implant, you place it in, or that metal alloy or that abutment, whatever, as a result of galvanism or whatever, then they blow up again. So again, this culture of scaring the patient into doing ceramic or not doing ceramic or whatever, I think it's unfair to the patient.
Yeah, I agree with you. So this brings to mind two patients. Firstly, it was that patient who came to me because she wanted and needed a full mouth of implants, and she didn't want to have metal. Because of what you've just been discussing, Sammy, she said, look, she goes, anything that I use that's metal, she goes, I end up in rashes and it's really irritating. I've been to see several different dentists. They've all assured me there's nothing wrong with titanium implants. And she was just of the mindset, I just don't want metal. Will you do ceramics for me? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we did ceramic implants, you know, I did all ceramic restorations for her as well. She came in very clued up. You know, anything that I'd recommend to her, she went on to immediately, you know, so she was actually a very reasonable patient. And there was another patient where, you know, many years ago, you know, we'd done a full mouth, rehabilitation for her. We'd placed titanium implants, which she had no issues with whatsoever. But when we placed the definitive prosthesis, she ended up with burning mouth syndrome. And we couldn't figure it out for ages. And then it occurred to us that it's very well could be that the bar itself is causing an issue, because the implants we used were commercially pure grade 4 titanium. But the bar was a grade 5 alloy. So we swapped the bar for a grade 4, and it wasn't easy finding that blank to mill the bar out of. Yeah. And that burning mouth sensation went away. So she was obviously sensitive to the other metals in the grade 5 alloy. But as you said, is there going to be a tipping point where, you know, she does end up sensitive to titanium as well? We don't know, you know. So this is kind of like why, you know, I've started to get more into ceramic implants, is because there are these patients who want it. And, you know, when you turn around and say to try saying to somebody who's adamant they want ceramic implants, titanium's completely safe to use, they won't come back. They just don't. No, and we have to respect it as part of informed consent, that's what the patient would prefer. You know, so correct. you can't bully a patient into titanium implants if they want ceramics. Yeah,
that's correct. And you just brought something up about these bars. I had a similar experience. Now let's pause for a second. When you do a full arch with a bar and framework and blah blah blah, how we all do it, or most of us still do it. You have to think about this. You have the implant. That's one alloy. You have the MUA. That's another alloy. You have the screw of the MUA. That's a third alloy. Then you have the bar. That's a fourth alloy. Then you have the screw for the bar. That's a fifth alloy. So when you think about this, like your patient with a burning mouth syndrome, and I've had a couple of those in my clinical practice, if you pause and think about, we're stacking up all these metals in saliva, which is one of the best electrolytes available. You create a battery mouth. And then you have this galvanism going on, and that leads to potentially this burning mouth. Because even from the same manufacturer, the implant and the screw are not the same alloy. Even from the same manufacturer, they're dissimilar alloys. And once you put dissimilar alloys together, you have a very high potential of galvanism. Okay, so I have had a similar experience where, you know, we changed the bar, or we changed the prosthetic parts, went and tried to get as close as possible to what the implant was made of, and it went away. But even in those scenarios, you still end up with at least three different alloys: the implant, the new better bar, and its screw. It's difficult to completely eliminate that unless you go ceramic and you go cemented, and all of a sudden there's no more screws, there's no more multiple alloys stacked up on top of each other. But then again, the consideration has to be where you might not always be able to do ceramic in every situation either, you know? So when I have these suspicious patients, if I like to call them that way, those that are likely to have a problem with metals, or I've had a history and claim it's gone, and there's some tests that you can do. And one of them is the MELISA test. It's a blood test. And what I like to always make sure people understand, it's not a test that measures your the amount of metal you have in your body. It's a test that measures how susceptible you are to be sensitive to a given metal. And they have panels. They have implant panels. They have amalgam panels. They have orthopedic panels. So these panels tend to have within themselves the different metals that can be in any given implant alloy. And there's an index. When you get the results, they draw the blood, send it to the lab, They do a sensitivity test. It's a lymphocyte test. It tests the lymphocyte reactivity to the given metal. And it says it gives an index. And if you're above a certain value, your likelihood of being sensitive to that particular metal gets higher. Okay.
Right.
So
what was the name of that test again, please?
MELISA, M-E-L-I-S-A. And you go online, melisa.org. It's there.
Yeah. Okay.
And this test is much better than a skin test, because that's another thing a lot of people think, a patch test, you know. Patch tests have now been determined to be pretty much useless to test for metal sensitivity for dentistry. Definitely not. Actually, some of them even induce sensitivity because to get a reaction on the skin, you got to expose that person to that particular irritant.
Yes.
And cause the irritation within that particular individual. Whereas with the MELISA test, you take the blood out of the patient and you go to the lab and you just assess how the lymphocytes are going to respond to that particular metal. So you're not inoculating them to see how bad a response is going to be.
Yes.
Absolutely. The big difference
much,
there.
Much better test. Much better test.
Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, my go-to's for ceramic implants, Sammy, as you know, I like the Breedent White Sky. Yes, the one-piece implants, but I like the fact that they have the clean implant foundation certification as well. And in my hands, they've been working really nicely. So yeah, it's, as I said, ceramic implants are already in my armamentarium, and I do feel like I want to offer more and more of them. So, based upon the back of this conversation, it seems to me that anybody who wants to get into ceramic implants needs to understand it's a different type of thinking, and therefore they should really have more training, even if they are experienced with implants. So, Sammy, you know, tell us about IAOCI and tell us more about, you know, how people can get trained on ceramic implants.
I will. You brought something up about a clean implant surfaces. I would like to preface my answer with that. This is another aspect that's also needs to be understood by clinicians, you, me, especially, because in a manufacturing of a dental implant, there's a lot of things that come into play. When you manufacture ceramic implants, even conventional implants, but definitely ceramic implants, there's three ways today that are commercially available to make a ceramic implant. Either you do injection molding or you do milling. So milling is essentially like what we do in our offices or our labs do. We have a milling machine, a block of zirconia. It gets milled into the shape of the implant that we want. Well, factories do that for us. They clean it, they wash it, they rinse it, sterilize it, and we buy them as practitioners. And we have the injection molded implants, which are made out of a slurry that gets put into a mold and baked and whatnot, and then you get implants that way also. Now, what we need to understand is that if you have a block of zirconia, it can only be milled with a metallic drill. So when you drill that implant, when you drill that block of zirconia with a metal drill, that drill is not made of pure titanium. It's made of stainless steel, which is also an alloy that has all kinds of other subcomponents into it. So that means at the end of, and then to mill that implant, you need a lubricant, which is usually some oily material or whatever. And then once that implant is milled under lubrication, it's rinsed with chemicals and packaged and gets to your office, it can potentially be exposed to a lot of contaminants. So what happens is the packaging can contaminate the implant, the manufacturing process can contaminate the implant. So that means you and I and our colleagues will get a perfectly sterile implant, but that is contaminated, either from the manufacturing drill, either from the lubricant, either from the packaging, because if you have an implant that comes and is bouncing around in the packaging, it's probably hitting the plastic surface of the packaging and scratching and picking up hydrocarbons from that. Now, that implant is sterile, but it's not clean. So now when you put that implant in the bone and you get these mysterious failures or these inflammatory reactions, sometimes it's because of the surface being contaminated. It's not contaminating in terms of material, not in terms that it's full of bacteria or viruses. No, no, no. That's not the contamination we're talking about. We're talking about a contamination coming from the process of manufacturing an implant. So this is something that I really wanted to address since you brought it up, and I'm glad you did. Sometimes you want to look to see that the implants that you, and it's, this is applies to titanium also, okay? But you want to really make sure that the implant that you're using is clean, has a clean seal. It has a clean approval, a clean surface approval. Now, the second part of your question was about the IOCI. The IOCI is the International Academy of Ceramic Implantology. I'm the founder. We've been in existence for about 13 years. And it was created out of the need to educate not only the doctors, primarily the doctors, but also the public on the availability and the benefits of doing of offering and choosing ceramic implants. Because in the early days, I realized, along with some colleagues, that yes, when I got into ceramic implants, I'd been doing implants for 10 years. I'm a trained implantologist. I took a residency. I spent 3 years of my life going to learn implant dentistry on a full-time basis. But when I took on ceramic implants, at least in North America, I had nobody to train me because I was one of the early adopters. And I had my titanium reflexes, my titanium knowledge, my titanium experience that I was trying to copy and paste into my ceramic journey. And the early days were difficult because there were some nuances that I didn't know. So the academy was created where we had an environment where there was going to be exchange of experience between, and by the name, by the way, the name is international. So we were talking to our colleagues in Switzerland, in Germany, in South America, all these, we were all getting together, and we still do, exchanging experiences, fine-tuning protocols so that we could minimize the amount and soften the learning curve for those already involved, but also for those coming after. So we have webinars, we have courses, our members have gone and have had their own courses. We list them on our websites. On our website, we have events every year. We have yearly events. We also go international. We've had events in the Middle East, in South America, in Africa. So our philosophy is education. We want to educate the doctors on how the good protocols. And I'm also proud to say that a lot of European ceramic associations were born out of IOCI. So a lot of the guys who started out in IOCI went on to Europe, Brazil, Argentina, and created other ceramic implant associations. So our goal is making sure that our colleagues understand better ceramic implants, make the adoption or the adoption of ceramic implants in the practice a lot smoother than it was for us 15, 20 years ago.
Amazing. Thank you. So, Sammy, this has been fantastic to learn from you. Thank you so much for joining me today. So it's, do you feel we've covered everything? Have I missed any critical questions or anything else you feel that we should speak?
Yes, I think we should talk about, I can give you the opportunity to ask me the question about what's the best way to cement
Yes, that's what I wanted to ask. Yeah,
you had it there. You forgot.
Yeah. I remember saying, "Oh, I need to make sure I ask you that question." So,
you can ask me now. I'll answer.
Yeah. So, Sammy, you know, it's what's your cementation protocol for these implants? Because I know a lot of people listening, they're going to be, I'm worried about cementitis and things like that. So what's been your experience? What's your protocols?
Well, again, that's where really understanding materials is very important. So zirconia, when we talk about ceramic implants, now we are cementing, where we're bonding really, because it's a chemical bond that we're creating now. We're bonding a ceramic to another ceramic. So the only way this connection, this cementation, to use that word, is going to happen is if we have a bond between the intaglio of the crown and the cement, and then from and the cement, and from the cement to the internal part, the surface of the abutment. So you need to connect two ceramics, and the bridge between the two ceramics is a layer of cement. The bond between ceramics is always done, it's a chemical bond. We need that chemical in between to connect things. So in dentistry, what do we use most of the time? When you cement a crown to a tooth, you use zinc phosphate or resin modified glass ionomer. Well, the surface of zirconia has free bonds, okay? So that means, for example, in your case where you did a one piece with a Breedent or any of us, once you leave zirconia exposed to saliva, these bonds get occupied by the phosphates that are within the saliva. So now that means at that point in time, so in the case of a one-piece implant or an abutment that was sitting in the mouth and got exposed to saliva at some point, you get those bonds occupied. Those were the bonds that were there available for the cement to occupy. But because now saliva has contaminated the surface, they are occupied and there's no more bonding connections for the cement to attach to. So coming back to your question, what's my protocol? First, I always decontaminate the surface of the zirconia. And how do I do that? A simple rinse, first of all. Then I use a material from Ivoclar called Ivoclean. So I decontaminate the surface, the abutment, with Ivoclean. Usually Ivoclean is not recommended to use intraorally, but I use it with high suction and I sometimes use a rubber dam so that the patient doesn't swallow it where I can. So put a rubber dam, decontaminate, rinse. On the crown, it's outside the mouth. Ivoclean, 20 seconds, rinse. Once I decontaminate that, you have an option. You can also do silanation, or you can do directly to cementation. But again, it's three steps. You decontaminate, two to three steps. But my protocol is to rinse, decontaminate, cement. And the cement of choice, the cement you should be using is a resin-modified glass ionomer. Zinc phosphate cements are not good because, again, those phosphates are going to go and occupy the bonds. And unless you have a mechanical retention, it's not going to allow for bonding. That's right. So resin modified glass ionomer cements with prior decontamination. You got to remove. Yes, because that whatever Ivoclean has, it has these zirconia components in it that go when you put that Ivoclean on the surface, it removes those phosphates. So now those phosphates that occupy the bonds on the surface of zirconia go and bond with the Ivoclean. So the Ivoclean basically cleans up the surface, removes those phosphate contaminants, and lets them and allows the bonds to be free so that the resin modified glass ionomer cement comes and occupies it and creates a bond. Others do a little more. They'll decontaminate, and then they use a silane or they'll use a primer. If you want to use a primer, what I do when I use a primer, I haven't used primer in a long time, but I used to use primers a lot, is that I'll decontaminate with Ivoclean, then I'll prime with something like Z-Prime, okay? And then do the cement, and then use the resin-modified glass ionomer cement. But the constant is a resin-modified glass ionomer cement, not zinc phosphate.
Understood.
So that's my protocol. Wow.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Simon, thank you. This has been really interesting. And it's recording on a Sunday as well. I really appreciate it. So, fantastic. So, Sammy, thank you so much for joining me today. Folks, please do look at the IAOCI. Sammy, what's your Instagram for people who want to follow you? What's the best one to follow you?
It's my first and last name, Sammy Numbisi. And on Instagram is IAOCI_ceramic implant.
Amazing. Thank you so much.